Part 090. It was just over a week later when an official-looking letter arrived. It was from a National Registration Office, and said they were trying to sort out records, since they had a Joan Mary Smith recorded as killed on the night of December 29, 1940, but that I had obtained a new identity card in mid-February 1941. Could I get in touch and provide my account of what happened? Alec Spencer was the solicitor I had gone to in December 1942, and he had prepared wills for Jack and I and held copies of them for us. Not that there was any money or property then to be concerned about, but after we were married, there would be some benefits if Jack should get killed on duty. And we had been saving while the war continued. In fact, I spent almost nothing while at the farm. Food and lodging was provided, so my pound a week had gone in a post office savings account. Mabel also shared the rewards from our ducks with me, along with the odd bonus when we got a bumper crop of something. Jack, too, had saved. Now we had the property near Bristol and we'd move there late in 1945 when Peter was thought to be coming home. He was in early and older than most, so his demob score was high. "Come in, Mrs. Morrison. Come in and tell me why you needed to see me." I telephoned as soon as I could to arrange an appointment. "I got this letter 2 days ago," I said, passing it to him now we were seated either side of his desk. I let him read it. "You look very lively for a ghost, Mrs. Morrison, but I'm sure that getting such a letter is very upsetting." "Yes. You see, I'm not sure of what really happened." "Why don't you tell me in your own words, and I'll make some notes, they are totally confidential, by the way, and then we'll see how we can sort things out. Let me say from the start that there must be thousands of cases where the records have the wrong name on deceased persons. Worse, there are people looking for loved ones who will never come home." I related my story. After telling about being with Jane and Doris, I continued. "There was a big bang, and the next thing I remember was finding myself lying in somebody's garden. Apparently unhurt. I must have been taken somewhere. From what my landlady, Mrs. Carter, told me later, I was brought back a couple of days after, and she'd been informed I was dead. I really don't remember much of what happened after the bombing on December 29, 1940, until a few weeks later, and even then I was still shaken up, though I had no apparent physical injuries. Then just as I was getting my life back in order, I was blown up again in the May 10th raids, and my accommodation and new job and new employers all gone. I can give you the address, 39, Hollyhock Road, though that hadn't yet been put on my identity card. There was a lot of confusion that night, and the ARP pointed me to a rest center in a church. I don't remember the name or address, just the names of two nice ladies. A Mrs. Appleby who had been a nurse in the First War, who cleaned up some scrapes on my hand and cheek and put a big plaster on my face, and Mrs. Hodges who gave me a pillowcase to carry things and a ripped old shirt I've fixed and still wear in the fields for work. But I asked the lady in charge, I don't remember her name, if it might make sense to get out of London since I had nothing to really keep me there. I thought I'd get to the country and possibly join the land army. I've this label on which the lady drew a map of how to get to Paddington Station from the rest centre. Mr. Spencer said keep that safe. It provides support for what you've said, and if necessary allows the rest centre to be located. But I strongly doubt we'll need to go that far. What you've said suggests that this girl named Doris perished with Jane Willis. Can you tell me what I need to do, Mr. Spencer? Well, since you've already felt it best to consult me, and I've got the information I think I need, why don't I undertake to write to the person who sent this letter? I'll very likely not tell them your whole story as that will take scarce paper and the more details the more questions may be asked. However, I will state that on December 29th you were with Jane Willis and a woman whose Christian name was Doris when a bomb exploded nearby, and while you did not suffer apparent physical injuries, you did suffer shock and confusion, to the extent you are not sure how you were returned to Mrs. Carter's address. Then as you were recovering, you were victimized by a second bomb, in which you did suffer observable injuries. With the disruption to civil infrastructure in London, you made your way to Taunton where you have lived and worked since. Would that be a sensible summary? Yes. I don't know if we told you, but Jack, my husband, was the first person I talked to here when I got off the train. I asked him where I should go to find accommodation and work, and he sent me to the WI. Well, that was a most fortuitous meeting. Mr. Morrison is an up-and-coming member of the police. And you'll no doubt be moving to your new property near Bristol soon. We hope to move in around Christmas time, I said. Peter Gaffney should be demobbed soon, and I want to get my own land producing. Good for you, Mrs. Morrison. Definitely not a ghost, I might add. Part 091. Later on I saw a copy Mr. Spencer's letter to the registration officer. It was masterfully worded to present a condensed version of what I had told him, while also telling the recipient to stop being a nuisance. September 18, 1945 H. Jacobson Registration Officer. Dear Mr. Jacobson. My client, Mrs. Mary Morrison, née Smith, is in receipt of your recent letter saying that there is a record of her demise on December 29, 1940. I can assure you she is very much alive and a contributing member of the Taunton community. So that you may correct the error, please note that Mrs. Morrison suffered from bomb blast while in company of Miss Jane Willis and a young woman whose first name was Doris. Miss Smith, as she then was, suffered shock and likely concussion and was not restored to her lodgings for several days, and took some time to recover. She was again the victim of a German bomb on May 10, 1941, this time sustaining visible injuries and losing her prospective accommodation, employment and employers at 39 Hollyhock Road. She provided to me names of potential witnesses as well as anecdotal and physical evidence of her activities that night, when she decided to come to Taunton in an effort to restart her life. I trust you will rectify the erroneous records with all dispatch so my client may put behind her a most troubling episode. Yours. Alexander Spencer, Solicitor. Part 092. That Christmas, the first after the end of the war, we spent at Phoenix Cottage. Cedric, Angela, and Audrey came. And while things were a bit disorganized, we managed a most pleasant time together. Jack and I got several rather practical presents of crockery and pots and pans, all second-hand but nevertheless welcome, and had managed to collect some furniture from disparate sources. We had, in fact, some furniture that was in the house when we acquired it, and I had spent some effort to clean it up. Jack had started living in the house in November. I moved in a week before Christmas. Jack was going to transfer to the Bristol Police, and there were discussions of a promotion to a new superintendent post to be created as and when Bristol and Somerset amalgamated their police services, whenever that occurred. We had to put Audrey on a sofa, but had the old double bed for Cedric and Angela, though with some reinforcement of the springs so it didn't sag so much. They brought some bedding with them, as we were still rather short. Also quite a bit of our Christmas fare, as rationing was now as bad as ever. Jack had been able to find me some Wellington boots and a large watering can. Audrey said, "Jack, that's so unromantic. A husband shouldn't give his wife such presents."
"Oh, no. You're wrong there, Audrey," I said. "I know most women would want something feminine and personal, but for me, what is found are the best presents I could imagine. I'll use them every day and be reminded who they're from. I'm only sorry that the best I can do for him is a sleeveless pullover that I knitted. Given the shortage of coal, I'll be very glad of it. And it can be worn under my suit. So I'm happy too," Jack answered. We had managed to find ourselves a new bed. Second-hand, of course. Our house was still a bit of a patchwork of different types and styles of furnishings, but it was functional. And it was, of course, ours, which was best of all. We made sure we could keep the kitchen cozy on the rationed allocation of coal and gas. I'd repurposed the blackout curtains, several layers, to draw across the kitchen doors and windows to keep drafts out, and had rag-filled snakes along the doorsills for the same purpose. Not all the rooms were in use, but they were cleared and tidy. Upstairs, we only occupied our own bedroom and the bathroom. Moreover, the living room downstairs and the study were, for the moment, mostly dark. We had, nevertheless, removed all the rubbish, cleaned thoroughly and fixed any egregious dilapidation. The rooms could be used when we were ready to do so. We anticipated that our location, about 3 miles from Bristol University, would offer us a chance to rent to a student or two. It was Oliver who gave us this idea, since he hoped in a couple of years to start studies in engineering there. We would certainly welcome him, whether or not we sought other tenants before then. Now that we were installed, I was planning what I'd plant this year. Since the field had been potatoes, I wouldn't have heavy digging, which was a relief. Being on my own, I decided to keep things as simple as possible, but I'd already started some strawberry seeds in the conservatory, despite the leaks. I'd grow some potatoes, mainly for the early new potato market, but a few for ourselves. We'd been scrounging material for a chicken run and some rabbit hutches. It would be work. I hoped Toby would be a good guard dog. Next year I might look for another dog, but didn't want Toby upset. One of Mabel's cats had had kittens, and we took one and then were given another locally. Jack made a flap for them to come into the conservatory, though occasionally we let them into the kitchen. Yes, we were softies. Still, it seemed that they were catching mice. Part 093. In mid-September 1946, Jack decided to take a day off to do some work on the house. We were re-roofing the conservatory, as we now called it. It would serve nicely for starting plants from seeds if we could get it fixed up. I was starting to think that a part of my business could be potting plants early in spring if I seeded them in protective locations. We'd even started to draw up some sketches of small lean-to glass greenhouses on three sides of what we called the garage, in which there was space where I already stored pots and tools. Given the cost of slates, Jack had removed them the weekend before and we'd rolled out some tar paper. Today he was sealing the edges and putting on some metal flashing. We weren't going to put the slates back yet, but had stored them for use on the main house or for reuse on the conservatory if we could get some of a similar size and shape. Once the roof was secure, we'd fix the places where the floor had some dilapidation from leaks. I was cleaning up the strawberry patch. I'd meant to do this several weeks ago. It had done quite well this year, though the only jam and preserves were my own, as I'd not yet joined the local WI. Still, I'd found several local greengrocers eager for my produce, especially the strawberries, and it hadn't been too difficult to find local children eager to earn some pocket money picking. Toby was lying nearby, keeping me company. He knew how to be close but not a nuisance. As I worked, I was vaguely aware of a car coming down the road towards Abbotsley from Bristol. Not too many people had cars, but there were a few more than during the war. Suddenly I heard a voice, "Excuse me. Can you direct us to the Bristol and Clifton Golf Club?" The voice originated with a rather blousy woman of perhaps 40, and the accent was, I thought, false posh. Toby slightly bared his teeth and made a low growl, but probably too quiet to be noticed from the car. He often made quick decisions on whether he liked or, as in the current case, did not like someone. I didn't want to shout, so I set my hoe against the wheelbarrow and walked to the edge of the plot, which was bordered here by a post and square wire fence. I was in my work clothes and had on my old men's trilby hat that served so well to keep my head dry and my face free from sunburn. I might even have been taken for a man. As I got near the fence, I could see the driver beyond the woman. William. I kept my head tilted a bit down, but could still look at the woman. As much in a West Country accent as I could, I said. Need to turn round and take first right. Then about 2 miles on T right. As I said this, I turned back to where I was working. Thank you. There, William. You see, I told you it was that road, but you wouldn't listen. Daphne. I did say I'd take the next turn. Bound to lead there. but I'll turn round at that entrance up 100 yards, or I'll never hear the end of it. I went through the motions of clearing the strawberry plants as the car did a 3-point turn at the nearest gate, then passed by to turn into Beggar Bush Lane. Jack had looked up and watched the proceedings. I walked over slowly. He said, "What was that about?" "A couple wanting to get to the golf club. Actually, William and Daphne." "Really? Since they drove away without hesitating, I'd assume there was no sign of recognition." "None whatever, I'm pleased to say. But I could use a cup of tea. Or something stronger."